system here. I'm Terry Fredheim. I teach Old Testament at Luther Northwestern Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is the fifth in a series entitled Old Testament Justice. And this particular topic today is Psalms for the Mistreated. Welcome to each of you on a Saturday afternoon, a warm Saturday afternoon. And let's do a few things together on some psalms that we haven't commonly paid any attention to. Are there Bibles to go around? I think it would be interesting for us to open our Bibles to the Psalms. Turn to Psalm 58, first of all. I think we should read two of them. Psalm 58. Do you indeed decree what is right, you gods? Maybe an ironic reference to people in power who lord it over others. Do you judge the sons of men uprightly? No, in your hearts you devise wrongs. Your hands deal out violence on earth. The wicked go astray from the womb. They err from their birth, speaking lies. They have venom like the venom of a serpent, like the deaf adder that stops its ear, so that it does not hear the voice of charmers or of the cunning enchanter. O God, break the teeth in their mouths. Never thought like that? Thought like that about anybody before? O God, break the teeth in their mouths. Tear out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord. Let them vanish like water that runs away. Like grass, let them be trodden down and wither. Let them be like a snail which dissolves into slime. Like the untimely birth that's a miscarriage that never sees the sun. Sooner than your pots can feel the heat of thorns, whether green or ablaze, may he sweep them away. The righteous will rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He will bathe his feet in the blood of the wicked. Wowie. Men will say, surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely there is a God who judges on earth. Let's look at one more, Psalm 109. Psalm 109. Be not silent, O God of my praise, for wicked and deceitful mouths are opened against me, speaking against me with lying tongues. They beset me with words of hate and attack me without cause. In return for my love, they accuse me, even as I make prayer for them. And so they reward me evil for good and hatred for my love. You've all said something like that at one time or another. But then listen to what goes on here. Appoint a wicked man against him, let an accuser bring him to trial. When he's tried, let him come forth guilty. Let his prayer be counted as sin. May his days be few. May another seize his goods. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. May his children wander about and beg. May they be driven out of the ruins they inhabit. May the creditor seize all that he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his toil. Let there be no one to extend kindness to him, nor any to pity his fatherless children. May his posterity be cut off. May his name be blotted out in the second generation. May the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Let them be before the Lord continually, and may his memory be cut off from the earth. And irony, for he did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted to their death. He loved the curse, let curses come on him. He didn't like blessing, may it be far from him. He clothed himself with cursing as his coat. May it soak into his body like water, like oil into his bones. May it be like a garment which he wraps around him, like a belt with which he daily girds himself. May this be the reward of my accusers from the Lord, of those who speak evil against my life. Thou, O God, my Lord, deal on my behalf for thy name's sake, because thy steadfast love is good. Deliver me. I am poor and needy. My heart is stricken within me. I am gone like a shadow at evening. I am shaken off like a locust. My knees are weak through fasting. My body has become gaunt. I am an object of scorn to my accusers, and when they see me, they just wag their heads. Help me, O Lord my God. Save me according to thy steadfast love. Let them know that this is thy hand. Thou, O Lord, hast done it. Let them curse, but do thou bless. Let my assailants be put to shame. May thy servant be glad. May my accusers be clothed with dishonor. May they be wrapped in their own shame as in a mantle. With my mouth I will give great thanks to the Lord. I will praise him in the midst of the throng, for he stands at the right hand of the needy to save him from those who condemn him to death.
His vengeance is what always bothers me.
Okay. There are some passages that should make your hair on the neck stand up a little bit. Thus far this week, we have been dealing with issues of justice in the Old Testament. We dealt, first of all, with some passages in the laws, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, that were particularly concerned about justice for the poor and for the needy. Last evening, we talked about these passages in the prophets and the preachers of Israel, if you will, who indict the people of Israel in very, very strong terms with regard to their abuse of power and wealth and their lack of concern for those who are poor. If you listen carefully, you notice that some of the same themes are present in these Psalms and in others. Some of the same language, some of those same vocabulary is present here. If you were to do a little vocabulary grid and put out the words that appear in those laws, that appear in those prophetic passages, you'd find them also popping up again and again in these Psalms. These Psalms are prayers for those people of whom the prophets and the law spoke. These Psalms are prayers for the poor, the needy, the disadvantaged. If you will, these are Psalms for people on their way to gas chambers. If you will, these are Psalms for people who are trying to outrun South African troops. These are Psalms for the truly oppressed. You know, we all of us experience harshness of one kind or another. And perhaps for most of us it's a little more than a harsh word, careless gesture. Sometimes it's more serious, like being abandoned, being betrayed, experiencing death on the part of somebody who's very close to us. But the word enemy is not a word which is a regular part of the vocabulary of most of us. And this word enemy appears again and again in the Psalms. We have great difficulty trying to come to terms with what that means because most of us don't have enemies. Probably about the closest we can get is something at the corporate level, where we might talk about enemies of the United States or something, and even there the language gets problematic. But when it comes to person-to-person level, you know, sit for a minute and see if you can list out persons who are truly what you would call your enemy. And so we have, I think, great difficulty in appropriating material like this because it's so foreign to our experience. It is so foreign to our experience. The most hurtful experiences that we have, I think, rarely, if ever, a call or a cry in the night, such as we see here. Let me come back and try to put some of this in context for you. There are a group of Psalms. In the study of the Psalms over the last century, we've learned that not all Psalms are of the same type. That you have to learn to define the literature that you're reading in order to truly appreciate what you're reading. Now, oftentimes, we do this without even thinking. When you pick up a Sunday paper and you turn to the comics, you'll say, the type of literature I'm reading now is the comics, I better pay attention. And then you flip over to the editorial page, you don't say, now I better keep in mind that I'm no longer reading comics. You know, I mean, you make a form critical shift in your mind, and you make a jump to a different kind of literature, okay? And you move to the sports page and the want ads and so forth. You're able to function in many different settings as what we call a form critic, able to discern the different types of literature that you're reading and recognize that you've got to have different rules of interpretation depending upon what you're reading. When we read the Bible, we tend to read it on the flat. And we tend to think that we're always reading the same kind of literature. And I think thereby, commonly, don't see the insights there that are there for us. Well, in the Psalms, there are many different kinds of Psalms. They're not all to be read of the body. There are hymns, there are songs of thanksgiving, there are wisdom Psalms, Psalms that are filled with proverbs, songs of entrance, songs of benediction, there's a whole range of Psalms. Well, one of the most common, in fact, the most common, this is filtered very well, I see, are the laments. Only one half of the book of Psalms consists of lament material. And these generally are cries on the part of the oppressed or those who are hurting in one form or another to God for deliverance. Generally speaking, that's the language used to describe it. However, oftentimes we read the laments on the flat too. You got something a little darker there? Great, thank you. We read the laments on the flat, and that's unfortunate. It's important to read them together because the laments will all tend to look alike in terms of their order, which I'll make notes of in a moment. But you do need to distinguish between what you might call regular laments, which are about two-thirds of the laments, okay? And secondly, the penitential laments, which is another, which 15% or so, and another 15% is what we would call the imprecatory, or, come on, okay, sometimes called the curse sounds. These are types of laments, cries to God at night over some hurt that they're experiencing. Generally speaking, their outline runs like this. It's a cry. You can see a pattern in almost every one of these Psalms. There's a cry to God. They're always addressed to God. Cry to God for help. Then a telling it like it is. Then a confession of faith or trust in the God that they're praying. A petition for help. God, deliver me, save me. You heard that language. And finally, some statement of confidence that God will in fact do what is being requested. That's a kind of lament shape that one can speak of here. Long been recognized on the part of scholars that that's typical in terms of shape for the laments. One of the things that that does is that it gives some order to a time when things are beginning to fall apart on you. You can try to get yourself trapped into a certain structure of language, and it assists you in bringing order in times of chaos. The regular laments really are the most common. They focus on innocent suffering and persons who are dying, persons who are ill, persons who are hungry, and persons who believe that God should be moving in to help them, and they cry out in the night. Penitential laments are the ones that are used most commonly in the Lutheran Church, and I think in most churches. An example of a regular psalm would be Psalm 13. A penitential lament, that's the ones like Psalm 51, have mercy upon me, O Lord, for I am a sinner. Focus on sin and guilt, and the deliverance here is forgiveness. And the imprecatory psalms, or curse psalms, two of which we read, they focus on oppression. They focus on the enemies. And the plea is for deliverance from enemies, a plea for justice, a plea for vindication. Now, We were talking a little bit, and I've mentioned this in a prior setting together. All of the penitential laments are in a hymn book. Okay, the LBW gets them all in. No question about that. I mean, they fit right into everything that we hold dear, I think. But with regard to all the imprecatory psalms are missing from the LBW. And quite a number of the regular laments are also missing from the LBW. They left out 28 psalms at the beginning of the LBW. 23 of them are laments. And the other five that are not particular laments have a kind of lament element in them, have an enemy element in them. And so there's been a judgment made on the part of the hymn book compilers that these particular psalms are inappropriate for Christian worship. By the way, if you were to go back to the service book and hymnal, the old red book, old red hymnal, maybe some of you remember that. There were some 40 psalms that were left out from that service book and hymn book, and I think like 32 or 33 of them were laments. And they even cut apart some of the laments. Psalm 69, for example, in the old red hymn book, they go through about 17 verses, and then they leave out four or five verses without telling you, and then they finish the psalm. I mean, it's just the history here in terms of the use of psalms in the hymn book is not very encouraging. Now, why do we do this? Why do we leave those materials out of the hymn book? Why have you, any of you ever heard a sermon preached on one of these psalms? You ever heard a sermon, or have you ever preached a sermon on? There have been a few here who have preached a sermon on the curse, not just the laments now, but the curse psalms. Okay? There have been a couple, I see.
After a presentation on the imprecatory psalms of Fulton a couple of years ago.
Okay. It's material that's very seldom used in the life of the church. So, one of the things that I'd like to suggest are some, let me just go through some reasons and let's get some conversation going here. I think that one can go to reasons like this, that Jesus told us to love our enemies. Jesus told us to pray for those who persecute us. Jesus' cry from the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, all seems to suggest that these materials ought to be set aside and not used by Christians because of those kinds of words of Jesus. I wonder, however, whether that's a sufficient response. I think that perhaps the most basic reason for their non-use in the life of the church is that this is but another way for affluent Christians to avoid the issue of the poor and the oppressed in our midst. I think that it just seems to me that if you take the spectrum of materials that we've been working with this week, the laws with regard to the poor and needy and how we neglect those legal materials, that social legislation and the Pentateuch, and many of those prophetic materials having to do with those judgments and that indictment, and these materials, I think that the pattern is too pervasive to suggest that this is not the real reason why we so often avoid the material. We try to escape from the problem. Now, let me just say a couple of things here that might be helpful in working with them, and then open it up. One of the things that's important for us all to recognize is that God is being addressed. Okay? God is being addressed. It's God who is asked to be the vindicator. The psalmist is not asking the courts to go to bat for him. If you go back into the legal materials, social legislation of ancient Israel, it's interesting that all the poor, oppressed, all the legislation associated with those individuals, there are never any penalties attached to them, as there are to many legal formulations. God is the one who is believed to be one who was to come to rescue these individuals. You remember that passage in Exodus 22? If you harm one of these little ones, I'll kill you. God's language. Very sharp. But God is the one who is asked to be the vindicator. Not asking other people to go to bat for him, and he's not suggesting that he or she is going to go off now and wreak vindication upon his own enemies, her own enemies. It's trying to get God to act. It's a negative way of saying, save me, deliver me. Another thing that's generally true about these laments, but not always, is that they usually don't end with a curse. They usually end with a more positive statement. But Psalm 137 is an exception to that. That's the psalm that ends, blessed are those who take your little ones and dash them against the rocks. That's ending with a curse. And so the pattern here doesn't always follow through. There are some psalms where a curse is final, and the psalmist moves on to other things with that curse still hanging there. But normally, the curse does not finally shape the material. Another thing is we need to remember that prayers are against insiders and not outsiders. The prayers are against insiders and not outsiders. And by that I mean that the prayers are not asked. They're not against people that aren't a member of your own community. They're part of these people that are being indicted, these people that are being called enemies, are people that are a part of the normal community of people of God. And finally, another thing that we perhaps ought to mention here is that to repeat what we've said a couple of times this week, is that salvation and judgment for Israel are always within history. They're not beyond history. That is to say, if there's no hell in the Old Testament where people can get their just deserts in the life to come, then you have to try to sort that out in here and now. And so that's one of the factors that work here, is that God is going to bring some resolution to the problem of this inequity in people's lives. In this life, there is no other life which one can fall back. So, the promises are this worldly. Salvation is understood not simply in spiritual terms. It's understood in physical terms. It's understood in material terms. And the God who is revealed here is a God who is not indifferent to evil. A God who is concerned about all aspects of people's lives, and who will be working unwaveringly to clean up the evil that's a part of the world. So those are some issues. But let's open it up for a while and talk about what strikes you. What are some things you're interested in suggesting or protesting with regard to this material? How much you use this material?
It's always been a confusion, you know, in terms of it's something I've set aside because it's so offensive, it seems, that could God really, you know, is this just out of the anger of a person rather than having a legitimate place in our day and age, that was primitive stuff, Old Testament, you know, and this was some of that culture, and it makes me think of capital punishment and a whole bunch of other things that come into the picture. So I avoid it.
Okay. Bob, you had an interesting comment before we started. Why don't you share that?
I think of the lament psalms let's say in the context of what's being expressed, and if there is hurt, anger, frustration, rage, I don't know if they were any more primitive than we are. Our culture seems full of that stuff. And as one who works in counseling, question comes, well, what do you do with it? And it seems to me there are really about three options. And you know, one discussion of depression, it's defined as rage turned inward. I beat myself down. If I don't turn it inward, I can turn it outward. And our culture is full of violence, murder, rape, rage externalized on one hand, internalized on the other. What else can we do with it? And the laments suggest that we address it to God. And it might be addressed to God like a youngster addresses a parent and says, you know, my brother, my sister hit me and I want you to, and a whole list of things come along. The parent says, well, I'll take care of it. And if there's a good relationship with the complaining youngster, then they can trust that the parent will take care of it. Now, that doesn't mean that the parent's going to take care of it the way that the youngster suggested. The parent will take care of it. And the laments are expressing rage about things that are out of kilter and addressing it to God, on the one hand, trusting that God can do something about it, and secondly, that God will do something about it. Now, I rather suspect, at least as the evidence is in the Lament Psalms, that the Hebrews were perhaps a much more believing community than we are. Because I wonder if we really believe God can do anything about it, and whether God will do anything about it. But I haven't heard of it. So that'd be the third thing. I'm just looking at Psalm 137. I haven't taken a list of all the lament psalms to check them all out. I was kind of going by the recollection that somewhere along the line, Psalm 88 is the only lament psalm that doesn't end in doxology.
The regular laments, so Psalm 88 is the only one that does. Not the curse psalm, the number of the curse psalms ends.
But the observation there is that this rage, anger, frustration, in the process of verbalizing that to God, believing that it's heard and believing that God will take care of it, however God's going to take care of it, then I can let go of it. Not only let go of it, but praise. That's how the regular laments end, doxology and praise. Praise God who heard and will deliver, which is the whole, you know, if everything is, let's say, rooted in the Exodus event, there were the oppressed, the slaves in Pharaoh's brickyards who cried out, were heard, were delivered.
We see
that's a pulse all the way through.
It's a pulse that follows through, but it doesn't always follow through with these sons. That's part of the problem. It's true for a lot for the regular laments, but not always so true for these.
When I hear
you don't get finally to the praise and thanksgiving. All of you do on Psalm 109, but not on 58 or on 137. Yeah, go ahead.
Am I hearing then that the psalm is just a way of letting out your frustrations without taking any action, right? I'm placing it in God's hand without any kind of feeling that, you know, God works through me and a righteous wrath on a situation like that, that I'm ready to carry it out. You know, I mean, is that what I hear? This is a psychological kind of an outpouring to relieve myself so that I won't become violent.
There has been some suggestions that the primary force of these, the primary value, excuse me, today is psychological. Let us say it's cathartic. Mm-hmm. You name the enemy. All of those, you know, good therapeutic directions to take. And so people end up then being or working with them only in psychological terms. But is that all that's here?
Well, like I say, that may be all that's here for folks today, for a lot of folks.
There's an element in it.
No, we would suggest that.
There's an element. You said most of us don't have enemies, but I think most of us do have enemies. We just don't think we're supposed to have enemies, so we won't own up to the fact that we have enemies, and we won't take oftentimes the anger and frustration seriously and deal with it. We try to pretend it isn't there. But when you're passed over for a promotion because somebody else has an in with the higher-ups in the organization, I think very oftentimes, at least what I hear in my office indicates, that you got an enemy. And you've got anger and you've got rage, and you may pretend you don't have that. You may really come in to talk about to the pastor about what was said in an adult class last Sunday morning. But really what you're struggling with is the fact that you've got an enemy. You'd really like to have them blitzed out of the organization altogether. And you think somehow God doesn't like you because of that. And what I find really refreshing here is the fact that you can talk to God about the fact that you're really pissed off. And that God somehow is big enough to handle that.
Good. Thank you.
I think my experience is that we're not big enough to handle ourselves so many times. I'm not that well prepared to be that kind of a battle with an enemy. I'm just beginning to see that that's what I've got to do now. I don't know what it takes. I guess the use of the Psalms or whatever. But it is a different reality, and that's really not good. Especially if you're going to be a person with some ethical or moral fiber in yourself, if you're going to live by the law, you might get enemies. That might get them.
Now, there have been a couple of further suggestions about the inappropriateness. It's amazing how we can come up with good reasons here. One is suggesting that the New Testament moves beyond these materials theologically. But it's not so. The New Testament has a doctrine of hell, sort of consigning people eternally to the fires of torment. That's a level of violence nowhere appropriated or in these Psalms. I mean, if you're going to suffer in hell eternally, how can you get more violent than that? In terms of the wicked, the enemies of the faithful, getting their just reward.
In Revelation.
And the book of Revelation has language, the imagery that's just as violent as this. And as you said right off the top, it's this vengeance in the Bible that bothers you. Okay? Another suggestion, you know, here that people try to work with is a kind of rhetorical overplay. It's hyperbolic. That you're dealing here with black and white, the good and evil kind of situation. And how can you best portray this? Johnny, I've told you a million times never to do that. Well, you probably told him 13 times or something. Well, he uses the language of hyperbole as a way of getting heard. It's a way of stating one's case such that you just simply can't, others can't escape from the force of your rhetoric. So that's another suggestion that the urgency in one's life begets kind of an extravagance of language. And that's important and helpful. But I think the overall effect of that is that you kind of back off from the actual situation. It's all rhetoric. There's nothing really going on here that's devastating important. One of the things, your comment about, you know, enemies in the corporate structures, one of the things I'm concerned about that, I think that's helpful. And I certainly think that at least some of these Psalms can be used for such people. I worry sometimes, however, that we think that our problems are comparable to faced by those on their way to Hitler's gas chambers, or the Namibians being hunted down by the South Africans, wherever in the world, there are comparable situations. I think I worry a little bit about making our enemy situation parallel to theirs and not seeing the difference.
But certainly there are members of my congregation who feel it, I think, with that kind of intensity.
Okay.
I don't think that's a sign of mental health or accuracy, but I think it's a sign of the existential experience of the person. I mean, I have people whose bodies cease functioning because of the rage they have towards other individuals, and they don't know that's why their bodies cease functioning, but it is. It very clearly is. And some of them simply decide to check out of life altogether. And I agree that it's not on the same level, but from the perception of the individual in the midst of it, I don't think they know that.
That's helpful. Very good.
I think a lot of the stuff that comes to my office is pretty silly, frankly. But I don't tell folks that directly.
Yes?
Reversing it and trying to get an understanding of how people might feel about us by reading it.
Okay, that we're the violent.
If we have an enemy, somebody might be my enemy.
Yeah, and I think that's what part of the reason we keep it out of the Book of Worship.
Okay, talk about it a little bit more.
Well, you can't. I mean, you get angry at someone. The corporate example is pretty good, but what if you're the person who got promoted?
How do you look around at the people that are around you who didn't get promoted, and how do you react to them,
knowing that most of them probably hit your guts? Not all that time, but it's not all that kind of thing, but there is that kind of thing that is.
Jody?
That seems to be an interpersonal version of what would seem to me to be the central sort of social metaphor that we're dealing with in our time in the United States, which is a consensus kind of metaphor, right? Conflict doesn't have much of a place in our understanding either of how the social structures of society work or how interpersonal stuff works or should work, right? And it could be because we're sitting on top that conflict doesn't make too much sense to us. People on the bottom seem to have easier time naming enemies, understanding that, in fact, there might be some fundamental conflicts within the society, understanding, in fact, that individuals and groups have very different interests from each other. I think we've just got a whole mindset to which these psalms are very, very foreign. And they'll not be foreign to a whole segment of the world.
Oh.
And the people who are preaching these kinds of psalms are named Mandela and Ortega, and they're looking it up.
Right, we're the oppressors, we're the enemies.
Mm-hmm. We may not have enemies, but those folks over there may. And we may do that.
Yeah.
Another dimension that seems to me is the idea of keeping things. Things have to look good. It's like the comment that I hear frequently, and maybe some of us have heard others say it, or you said it, well, here's a problem I have, but I'm not going to tell my pastor about it. You know, what would my pastor think of me? Things have to look good and sound sweet. These kind of songs don't. You don't chant these with a smile on my face. So it just doesn't fit with the sugar and Jesus.
Or let's extend that a little bit. Is it a problem with our understanding of what prayer is? Have we got a kind of a perfect prayer syndrome or something like that? That in our talk to God, in our conversation with God, everything has to be sort of polite and courteous and positive, and that there's somehow not room for this more violent kind of conversation.
Pretending that this other stuff doesn't really exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Or with each other as Christians.
Excuse me?
Or with each other as Christians. We always have to be positive and use certain kinds of language.
I have less trouble in my own prayer life venting my spleen. You know. And but if I were to vent my spleen from the pulpit or something like that, well, that would be a completely different situation because of the reaction that I could get that would be offensive and been told another time. Doing something like that.
But,
and then get put in a box like, you're that kind of person. Because you did that once.
Then you should have gone to the mutual ministry.
It isn't that I don't have those feelings of the systemic injustices in the community and in the country and in the political scene. And, you know, I could blame, you know, but I try to avoid that for the sake of not breaking a communication.
Yeah. I think that you're talking about things at the individual level and the importance of expressing matters of this sort to God sort of one-on-one, if you will. I think what's been raised here in a number of comments is that the systemic issues, the corporate issues, the issues of a people, there may be more important reasons why that kind of conversation ought to take place publicly. These psalms, I think, were written not simply to be used by somebody in their closet in the evening in praying to God. These psalms were also used publicly. They were used by persons in a worship situation and voiced publicly. Now, I think, what does that contribute if they're voiced publicly? What does that bring to a situation that just a one-on-one with God doesn't bring? Why would that be important to pray prayers like this out loud in a community?
If the person is addressed, or if targeting is a part of the community, as you suggest, I don't know whether your enemy is sitting across the synagogue from you when you use this or not, but that would certainly change the dynamic of the community if it's out in the open.
Okay, that would be one possible effect. let's get what is occasioning the conflict out in the open and deal with it as a community.
Look, there's an intercessory dimension. This may not be my psalm today, but whose psalm is it? And it may be maybe a mother in Namibia, or somebody in Central America, or a refugee in Texas. And it, you know, some sister or brother in our Christian family.
So, by voicing these particular materials, you choose to identify then with this wider Christian community, and you then assist them in the articulation of their concerns in public and before God. So there's a sense in which, in that corporate identity then, with, it may not be your prayers, but in praying them with those who are part of your community, you identify with that concern, and that makes all the more forceful than the articulation of prayer.
I'm close to that one. It would be the solidarity that if I verbalize my anger, I'm not finding a person next to me has the same anger.
Okay. And, or even extending it, Dean, go ahead. Before.
Well, I was thinking about the Hebrew concept of word, that once you spoke that word, it had a life of its own, and it would accomplish it. At least that was true of God's word. And as I think about why we couldn't withdraw the blessing, because the blessing had already been spoken unto Jacob rather than Esau. So the same way also the true power of this curse, that once you speak it, it has a life of its own that would come if you put it into play. So it isn't just relieving your own anger or rage, but it is an effective, effectual word.
It gets the word out there. Yeah. It, okay, once it's spoken, it gets, it takes, it has a public life. It gets carried out and about in a whole variety of ways that would not otherwise be the case if it weren't articulated. And hence, it's more powerful. That's right.
The place that I've heard impeccatory psalms created spontaneously in my lifetime has been a demonstration where they're cursing the judge at the trial. Things, one that I can think of very clearly, it really has a powerful effect in terms of the mob psychology. You get the adrenaline flowing, blood coursing through the veins, and the eyes bulging, and greed flowing.
Yes, okay, good.
But, you know, that's really where it happens, is in the streets where the struggle is taking place.
During the Vietnam War, though, there was an awful lot of congregations were polarized because of pastors were able to raise some issues and specifics throughout those 10 years or so. And that was a consequence that caused a lot of pastors to resign from the church.
Congregations were polarized, but demonstrations were galvanized. Mm-hmm. We were really electrified.
Don, you had your hand up.
I was just thinking about the events of assassination of John Kennedy. I went to church that day after he was assassinated, and many people, I think, came to church filled with all kinds of feelings. So when I came home, I turned on the television and said, I thought, oh, that's Jack Ruby, and you know, shot Oswald and killed him. There was a sense that the physical acting out of the hatred upon what was perceived as the enemy was done right while people gathered to try to formulate the worship response. And a similar thing happened after King's assassination, where many people took the streets, dealt with demonstrations. The only way they could express this rage was through violence on the streets. And I felt that I didn't know how to react. So I had the feeling of rage, but I didn't know how to react. And as a Christian, as a nonviolent person, how do you really deal with the rage if this great leader has been killed?
So picking up a couple of these psalms might have been a great assistance. Yes?
I have some thoughts, and I don't know where they're going to lead, but it seems to me that I remember from my own life that I can only be angry at someone that I love. And it seems when I'm reading this, there's a sense of betrayal that someone that you've got a hope in or a trust in has betrayed you. And I think sometimes in our country, when I become so cynical about what our country can do as an entity to help the poor or the sick, that I've lost a sense of love, and so I can't be angry anymore because I'm just as cynical as a slave.
So something that really matters to these people. The relationships that are at stake here.
Well, if it would bring the circle around to your comment about what's in and what's not in the LDW, you know, we have omitted the resource of the lament psalms to a large extent, and even the ones that are in the LDW, how much are they used? The lectionary still skips over verses in psalms or uses a part of the psalm.
Or you take hymn paraphrases of psalms. I know of only one hymn in the whole hymn book that's a paraphrase of a lament, or all kinds of them that are paraphrases of hymns and shepherd psalms and what have you, but very few. Ken?
Well, I think a good use of this is to give permission to express anger, and that's a therapeutic type of problem, I guess, is that we do suppress our anger so much. And to express anger in some settings to release it, I know it can be therapeutic. There's also a danger involved in doing it too, and maybe, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the dangers of that as well. I'm concerned, for instance, about one of your earlier comments. You suggested that the category enemy are insiders. They're people of the household of Israel. I take your word that you're the scholar who studied that, but does that mean when we move to the New Testament, it's the same thing? Love your enemies means only love the insiders, that we can love the outsiders, that we can allow, a Reagan to say that we can hate our enemies? Because if that's the kind of permission that is given, then I'm not so sure if I want to use these songs in that way.
Yeah, I think that the carryover, the phrase in the New Testament, love your enemies, I think is universal. I don't think that's a reference to inside at all. I think that there is, in Psalm 137 and maybe one other, there might be a reference to outsiders, that's to say, but it's to the foreign armies which are on Israel's doorstep, so that might be an exception to the normal insider reference.
I heard Bosak say one time that in a tape that came about Namibia and South Africa, that the whole apartheid system started with communion in South Africa, because of the whites that came there would refuse within the church. Now this is a churchman saying this, would refuse communion to blacks. And at that point, I used that tape at church. A little bit devastating for them to hear that. Mm. It came out of the church.
One of the, when we try to put these passages alongside love your enemies, I think we need to be very careful. We sometimes try to flatten out scripture so that we try to reconcile everything in the scripture so that everything fits, just so. I think we need to recognize that the Psalms are occasional literature. They arise out of particular occasions in the lives of people, and certain concerns are voiced in those occasions. So you can't just take a psalm like these and plug them into any situation and say that they're sort of universally valid or they're universally applicable. It may well be that you could never pray these psalms, really, because you've never had such a devastating experience as possible. So you need to be careful, I think, not to sort of universalize this kind of material and suggest that the God who is revealed in them is the God which is generally revealed throughout the scriptures. These are people have these feelings about God, and they're given freedom to voice those feelings about God. And one ought not be hold them accountable to have to integrate those understandings of God into a nice doctrine of God. Recognize the occasional character.
When you say in that statement that these show a whole lot more from people than we do of God, say a whole lot more about people. As I listen to people, I come to listening for what they say and what it's saying about them, not about me or somebody else, but what they're doing. Is that where we ought to listen to these songs?
I think so.
Not project all this on God.
Right.
God showing himself.
Or not think that somehow the understanding of God that's revealed in these texts has the same level of import as for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him. I mean, this is spontaneous kind of stuff that's in the moment of rage, in the moment of difficulty, in the moment of torture, or whatever. It's just... I'd hate to have my prayers uttered in a moment of anger somehow brought into, into a dogmatics textbook and say, now, Fred, you're going to be held accountable for your doctrine of God that you voiced in that moment of anger. But I think we sometimes do that to the Bible. We level it all out. We think it all has the same level of theological importance. We don't keep its occasional character enough for us.
Would it have been appropriate then to use some of those demands, for example, at Naomi's funeral, or at the Southwest funeral? We all sat there, and all we wanted to do was be angry before we heard good news.
Anyone ever used any of these in occasion? These are two, my wife Faith, two teenagers that were killed accidentally within a year in our congregation. Anyone ever use a psalm like this in a funeral situation? Isn't it interesting, though? Isn't it the penitential laments that we commonly use?
Yeah, not the penitential, the regular.
You have used the regular one?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, like Psalm 130, out of the depths of I cry to you, O Lord, that's a potential lament. We tend to move immediately to sin and guilt stuff, and not the innocent suffering kinds of dimensions that we find in the lament material. I'm happy to hear that some of those are getting picked up. I think that would be an appropriate occasion. Anything else? Let me just take a couple of minutes to give you a few sentences to conclude this. I think that these psalms, in addition to functioning as prayers for other people and perhaps for ourselves, maybe can have the function of kindling within us some sense of what it must be like to be the victim of brutality and injustice. These psalms have the shocking immediacy of a scream in the night. And maybe they can startle us into feeling something of the desperation of persons who have to go through brutal actions on the part of other human beings. It may be that unless we pray these prayers so that we can hear these cries in the night, that we will be less outraged than we ought to be at what Psalm 74 calls the dark places of the earth that are full of the habitations of violence. And so we might use these psalms then for remind ourselves of the awfulness of life that has to be lived by so many of our fellow Christians. And maybe they would also could have the function of reminding us of those violent corners in our own lives, those thoughts of oppression, if not acts, and maybe those deep-seated feelings that lurk in our own hearts can meet the judge of all the earth if we voice them to him. And finally, I think that maybe we can say something here about God. God reads the whole situation, the words spoken, the context in which they're spoken, the surface of what we say, and the deep feelings that lie underneath what we say. God is always less shockable than we are. Or perhaps the way to say it is, God is shocked and moved by things different from what we commonly are. And since he has so identified himself with the oppressed in Jesus, who was also a victim of brutality and rage, that because of the experience he has undergone in Jesus, he knows most deeply whereof the prayers of these prayers speak. So these psalms, I think, should be contemplated for what they are, as the cries of our brothers and sisters in times of great hurt. And they should be translated, I think, finally into denunciations of the hosts of wickedness in our world, and the affirmations that God is at work to rid the world of evil. And that statement from Heschel last night, God, to most of us, these matters are a misdemeanor. To God, they're a disaster. And I think such psalms should help shape our life for the vision of the depths of evil in our world, and the sight of its victims should move us to become more sensitive to people and their needs. And it finally, I think, should open us up to see somewhat more deeply into the heart of God and what God must feel like when he looks into the face of an Ethiopian child. I think that these materials can be of help to us in a variety of ways, and I hope that maybe we can all find some ways of making use of them in the days to come. 5:00, thank you very much.